Hey, I'm Jeff Reed.
I'm Craig Killian.
And this is the From First to Last podcast. This is a From First to Last podcast. It's a podcast where my friend Craig and I, we get together each week and we work our way through a director's theatrical filmography from their first film all the way through to their last. And Craig, we are sort of at the midway point of Michael Mann's season.
Now, is it the peak of the mountain?
Oh.
Are we at that midway point? Are we at the peak? Is it all downhill from here? There's so many questions. So many burning questions in our minds and our hearts. Very melodramatic this morning.
I love it. I love it. Now, before we really dig in, we are talking Michael Mann. It's our seventh season and we are still in lockdown. We're living that lockdown life, aren't we, Craig?
Yeah, we are. So we're a little bit stir crazy. Thank God for the Goods Coffee.
Yes, we love our friends at Glee Coffee.
Thank you guys. Thank God we're keeping us alive, keeping us from going crazy and just burning down the house.
Yeah, there are little moments that you just want to make everything burn. Like our grinder started breaking the other day for our coffee, Both Kathy Lee and I were like, literally, if we have to, and our kettle broke the same day. So we were like, literally, if we have no kettle and no coffee in the same day, this is just going to be the worst ever.
just looking up to the sky. Oh, Lord, why? Why, yeah. Lord?
Totally. So we have, we're really in the meaty bits of Michael Mann's season, aren't we, Craig?
Yeah, we're really on his, I think we're really in his peak times.
Yeah, we've come off the back last week. We talked Last of the Mohicans.
Yep.
And what I was really, really blown away by was the shift in scale from Manhunter to Last of the Mohicans.
Yeah. Definitely.
We go from this very contained thriller to just this sweeping epic.
Oh, yeah. And you just go from something that's, well, obviously just little crime drama, it seems like, to the actual French colonial wars. You know? Yeah. You're just like, this is weird. This is weird. It's almost like it's like an Ang Lee move.
Yeah, totally. It's one of those things. And when you... I think that's something that both you and I have been surprised by this season so far, is that when we've thought about Michael Mann, we've seen a crime director.
Yeah,
so a director that specializes in heist films, in crime dramas. And we're realizing that four films in, that Mann is actually quite versatile in the fact that he's jumped from a heist film in Thief, which really became more of a mob film, in a sense.
Yeah, exactly. It was a very, very thriller. It turned very thriller very quickly.
And then we jumped over to The Keep, which is this gothic sci-fi crazy movie.
Just too much cocaine and Gabriel Byrne.
Yeah, that's right.
And weird Ian McKellen.
Yeah.
A young Ian McKellen trying to look old. And all I ever knew him was for fucking old. So it's just so weird to see. It is just the most random, weirdest thing you ever see. Because you just look at him and you go, yeah, I know what you look like when you're old, man.
I might actually do a little thing. I went down a rabbit hole when we'd finished that episode, which was to look at photos of famous old actors as young people.
Mm-hmm.
And Ian McKellen, I found this photo of him on a motorbike. He just looks like, he honestly looks
good-looking,
so handsome.
Dude, man.
And then it got me in a rabbit hole. James Earl Jones is a handsome devil. Just all these people in their younger years who are just like dashing young people.
They had that golden era look, you know, that golden era of Hollywood look about them, you know, the big square jaws, even like James Earl Jones did and stuff like that. But it's funny, we never jumped on board. Well, obviously, because just our age as well. We never jumped on board until they were already, you know, Gandalf age.
It's so true. I think thinking back to Last of the Mohicans as well, Craig, something that really has sort of been cemented for me is we've sort of been learning along the way just how meticulous a director and a storyteller Michael Mann is.
To the point of quitting.
Yeah, to the point of we learn
people around him.
That's right. People are starting to be offended by it and not really be able to work with him in a sense because he demands such a high quality and he has such an ideal in his mind that he wants to hold on to. It's very unrelenting way of making your films, isn't it, Craig?
Definitely. And it's funny to see because basically I think this is a director at his... And you can see it in his films as he's come along, a director that he's most confident, but he's also a director who's been burnt too many times.
Yes.
And I think this is him showing, well, I'd rather be burnt doing my movie than burnt trying to do someone else's.
100%. And Mohicans really showed that. And I think it's really interesting into the season of his filmography that we're stepping into now, which is really, Mohicans really announced Mann as a big director. So this is like Mohicans, he's now a Hollywood director.
This is where he's just like, okay, I get big budgets from now on.
Exactly. And I've got clout.
When thinking of his movies coming up and everything, I think this is at his... technically his best qualities, and it doesn't stop from now. Quality, what technical quality, I don't know whether the movie is dislike or dislike. I think this is where he just technically he'll be at his best.
Yeah, totally. And I really love seeing how that will play out over the next couple films.
Because when we think
about what we're talking today, you would argue that this is, in the public's mind, this is his big film.
Definitely. And this is his Point Break. This is his Forrest Gump. This is his, what would you say Snyder's is?
Oh, Snyder's.
You can't say Justice League. Justice League is more mired in the fact of its controversy. But like, what will his badge be?
I think if he hadn't had dramas with, even if, I think in time to come, Snyder's will be 300.
You reckon?
Yeah, because I think 300 is that film that announced his arrival in a massive way.
And he announces his signature too, doesn't it?
Yeah. And so I think it's that movie that when people learnt who Zack Snyder was, same with, you know, again, with Zemeckis, Back to the Future is a film that people adore, but I don't know whether Zemeckis fans would argue with me on this one, but I don't think it's the film that people would go, a Robert Zemeckis film.
Yeah, exactly. It's not his signature. It's not a signature film.
Yeah, totally. And so I think if we're to say what is the film that defines Michael Mann's career and really is the forefront for people, when I talk to, I like to think about it, if I had to talk to my wife or my family about who the director is that we're doing, what's the one film that I would say, oh, they made this film? And the first film I would lead with is Heat.
It's whatever's in his first line of his Wikipedia page.
Yeah, totally. or the first poster on his IMDb.
Or the first word on the when he dies. Director of.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think Heat is, and with good cause, because this is an incredible film. I'm saying it just straight from the get-go.
Not that anyone should be surprised.
Yeah, totally. And in our preparation for this week's episode, we actually, Craig and I, realized just how much of a wealth of information there is about this film. After watching this almost 3-hour epic, we realized that just talking about the film alone would require more time than we would be able to fit in our normal 90-minute sort of window that we give.
Exactly.
So we made the conscious decision. We have split this into two episodes. We had advertised at the end of last week that we would have a special guest for this episode.
Oh, yes.
Which, we're very excited. Blake is still joining us, but he'll be with us next week to talk the film in depth. He wasn't going to... We just thought, let's really get the man who knows all about Heat to not pull apart the journey to screen and all this stuff that we do at the start of the episode.
Very exciting.
We'll get into the meat, and we're really excited for that. So I do have to send an apologies to Blake in our teasing his joining us. I said that he'd recorded 300 episodes about the film Heat.
Yep.
He's actually done about 180, so I oversold him there, but he has a wealth of podcasts out there on his One Heat Minute Productions banner.
He's done easily over 300 podcasts.
Yeah, he's done well in advance of 300. So, he really, I'm so excited to hear what he's got to say. And so, yeah, I'm really excited though, Craig, to dig deep on Heat, because I think this is one heck of a film to talk about.
Oh, yeah. One heck of a film. One film that basically is just a movie that I've grown up with.
Me too.
As a movie lover. Not one of those movies that you're almost indoctrinated with when you're a kid. You know what I mean? You watch them and so you think you're a kid watching them. But one of those movies that you discover as just as a movie lover.
Yeah. And it's funny, isn't it? Because I was just had this weird thought then. Remember in Dawson's Creek or in any sort of Hollywood trope where there's a movie nerd or a movie fan who is an aspiring filmmaker, they always have a poster on their wall that's sort of like, oh, I adore this film. It's the film that made...
He was a Spielberg fan, Dawson.
He was. He had a Jurassic Park, if I remember,
poster
up on his wall.
Poster up. And
But I'm really surprised that, like, in films where or TV shows where they do that nowadays, that there isn't more references to Michael Mann's Heat, because it really is that sort of... You could go to film school and study this film, which I guess is what Blake has done himself, to pull it apart minute by minute and do an hour-long episode on one single minute of each minute of Heat.
There's like gigantic texts and books about the cinematography of and the actual work of Michael Mann.
It's incredible.
I almost bought them, but they're ridiculously expensive.
Dinner, I have had the same research and thought as well, Craig. I'm like, I don't know if I can spend $170 to hear someone talk about
this.
Like
fucking, and they're huge. And you're like, I'll be honest, I'll probably get bored reading it, because by the time I'd be finished halfway through it, I'm on to another director where my focus would be on another director.
Yeah. It's so true. Because I guess, and this is something I'm learning about Michael Mann that I wasn't really aware of, is the fact that every film is so well thought and so deep that you can't help but like feel as though there's all this. You could just pull every film apart and just go down a rabbit hole, couldn't you?
Yeah, so I guess, and that's one of the surprises. I know every season we go, oh, I'm surprised at this, I'm surprised at that. But my surprise is never been his talent, because I've always known his talent, but it's his depth. And his depth is just, I didn't realize how in depth he was.
Yeah, totally, totally. So, Craig, should we get into it?
Go for it, bro.
All right. So we've had 3 years since the release of The Last of the Mohicans, and through to the release of Heat, that is. And by no means is this a quick journey for Michael Mann to get to Heat. If we think of, say, a Ron Howard who is putting out a film every 18 months on average.
Feels like every 2 days. Towards the end there.
it totally did. But as we heard last week, Mann sometimes has an idea of a concept, like we found in The Last of the Mohicans, that sits with him for a very long time. And Last of the Mohicans, for those who haven't heard the episode yet, check it out. But it was basically a childhood idea that he had, and it sort of rattled around in his head from the age of 3 to when he actually put the film to screen. So I guess that's really a real insight into how much thought he's constantly putting into what his next project is. And I love that I actually found this really cool. It's a documentary that accompanied the Heat Blu-ray and DVD called Man Made, which is the, he talks about the journey from, and we'll hear about a TV film called LA Takedown in a minute, but the journey from LA Takedown through to Heat. And Man actually starts discussing why it takes so long for him to find what his projects are. And he actually, it's really quite fascinating, and we'll get there a bit more, but fascinating. He almost laments the fact that he is unable to pump work out. And so he wants to be one of these directors that drops work every year or two. He says himself,
but he ends up like Catherine Bigelow.
Well, and there is really, we've found strong parallels in the Bigelow season to Michael Mann. And what I'm finding more and more is that there are so many parallels between Bigelow and Michael Mann in this season. And one of them is he wishes that he even talks about, I wish I was a journeyman. And I've got the quote for later in the episode. In my mind, I hear him sort of go, I wish I was a Ron Howard who would just get a project and make it work. But to him, he just wants to be challenged, and he wants an idea that he's never going to doubt that he's making the right movie because he's just so set in, this is what I want to do.
I think he'd be the type of person that if he knows clearly how to make the movie within the first 10 minutes, he doesn't want to do it.
Yeah, totally.
You know what I mean? Or even the first like week, he'd be like, nah, man, that's too easy. Let's get on to, I need something else.
I love it. And I think this is a really big factor in the way that the journey that Heat has to screen. It's a concept that it's actually spanned Mann's entire career so far. And I guess, as we've already talked about, it's a film that still lasts. Like, this is his legacy film. It's the film that people are going to talk about for the remainder of his career. So the gestation process for this film is something that starts before Thief and continues all the way through his career to date, including a TV series version, a TV film, and just a whole heap of craziness. So before we really kick things off, Craig, I just thought, let's get there. We'll just quickly do a quick refresher on the film itself, and let's just take a moment and let's just hear about it.
Detective Vincent Hanna attempts to track down master criminal Neil McCauley against the backdrop of glamorous Los Angeles. As they both try to deal with the chaos in their lives, McCauley and Hanna discover a mutual respect, even as they try to thwart each other's plans. Robert De Niro and Al Pacino lead an amazing ensemble cast in Michael Mann's heist classic. Let's talk about Heat.
Now, Craig, Heat was released theatrically on the 15th of December, 1995, and it took over $180 million at the worldwide box office. It's pretty huge, isn't
That's
it?
That's huge. What year again?
95.
Damn. You're 11.
And year 11. Wow. I think I was in...
I'm old as shit.
Yeah, you are, man. Sorry. Yeah, man.
I'm like that freaking... That shit's that's turning white. 3-4 day old shit.
Heat also had a... Oh, I've just realized what you were saying. That's so gross. ready to be mown over in the backyard.
Yeah, exactly. Not exactly crusty where you run over and it turns into dust. And you go... Not that one. The one that you run over it and it still has a fresh smell in the middle. Because you think, oh, this will be safe to run over. But you're like, ooh, that's not safe at all.
So Heat took $180 million, a bit over it, and had a budget of $60 million.
That's superb.
So it's a pretty good return. And 1995 is actually a really fascinating year for film. And so we'll just take a little snapshot now, Craig, at what was going on around that time. I think it gives a great little context. And I think it's also great to know $180 million is quite a good amount of money made for a film.
It's fantastic.
But is it something that qualifies it within the top films of that year? And I think the landscape has really started shifting since Last of the Mohicans.
Mm-hmm.
We've become more blockbustery, and the animation industry in particular has really shifted, which is this is the very first film from Pixar. Toy Story is released, and it really sets in motion the shift away from cell animation through to what is now your 3D computer-generated animation that is pretty much stock standard with animated films these days.
Yeah, it has to be, unless they want that nostalgic feel to it.
That's exactly right, Craig. Also, a really major thing that happened was Carolco Pictures filed for bankruptcy.
Oh, I love Carolco.
Now, this story is a really fascinating one, and I'd encourage everyone to jump out there and have a listen to our Spider-Man episode in season three, because we dive really deep into the Carolco saga and the way that it plays out for the Spider-Man films. There was an iteration that that almost featured James Cameron directing Spider-Man under Carolco Pictures, because they are the studio that brought us.
That would have been awesome, because I know Cameron would have actually invented a web slinger.
So true.
He would have had it. We would have had an actual working prototype.
Yeah, a physical one.
Yep.
Maybe that's the real reason.
And would
that
have had DiCaprio
bankrupt.
just swinging on everything.
I love that you brought DiCaprio up, because he's coming in a minute. So Carolco were the studio that released the Rambo franchise, the Terminator films, and the Spider-Man rights was something that really became this big battle for them, and it became so embroiled around a legal system that at one point there was almost a swap deal that gave Carolco part ownership of the James Bond franchise, which is just absolute madness. So listen to that Spider-Man episode. I think it features our good friend Andy Milos, if I remember rightly.
Ooh,
as well.
Mr. Milos.
So we do love Andy. So also on this podcast, we've talked about three other films from 1995 as well. So we'll get there in a moment, but they are Sam Raimi's Western, The Quick and the Dead.
Oh, yes. John loves that movie.
Featuring our own Uncle Johnny.
Loves it.
Ron Howard's incredible Apollo 13 was released.
Fantastic.
And Catherine Bigelow's very innovative but very visceral Strange Days was released
as
well.
Still loved it. Loved it.
So considering Heat took $180 million and doesn't even come close to the 10 highest grossing films of that year. In fact, what was really fascinating, and the numbers nerd in me, you know I like a few numbers here and there, Craig, is that the top seven film, really, there's only about $20 million between the top seven films.
Oh, wow.
So it was a very evenly distributed year, not like nowadays where we have a couple $3 or $4 billion films and then we drop down to our $300 million films. So the number one film worldwide was a third film for a franchise, Die Hard with a Vengeance.
Oh, really? That's a good franchise, though. That's a very good franchise. That very much took it out of that claustrophobic feel, but still sort of kept the 24 feel. That was really like a precursor to 24.
I love it. The number two film was Pixar's Toy Story.
Fantastic.
Number three, we have talked about on this podcast, it's Apollo 13. Tom Hanks, Bill Paxton. What a film. Number four, GoldenEye.
Ooh, my favorite Bond. I'm not going to get into it because I'll start gushing.
Yeah, don't, Craig. Number five surprised me at $346 million, Pocahontas.
Oh, really? I still haven't seen it, hey.
Also won an Oscar that year for Best Original Song, which was Colors of the Wind.
I couldn't think of that. That's the one Disney film that I am just blind to.
I think go back and check it out. It's quite good. We've got, if I remember rightly, we've got Mel Gibson in there. Maybe even Christian Bale voices a character on there. So
plausible.
Some big voices on it. It's not bad. Number six, Batman Forever.
Fantastic.
And that, we will
Val Kilmer one.
Yep, Val Kilmer, and it will play a very big part in the production of Heat. Old Batman Forever.
Oh yes.
Number seven, aptly, is David Fincher's Seven.
Oh, really? That's a whole podcast in itself.
Yeah, totally.
That's a whole series in itself. You know,
that is a whole series in itself.
The one heat minute, bro.
Yeah, totally. 7 minutes in seven. There you go, Blake. Jump on that. Next up was Casper at number eight.
Oh, I love it. I loved
it. And number nine is a film Craig adores, Waterworld.
Ooh, well, it's Kevin Costner. It's Kevin Costner. It's not, and it's nowhere near as bad as everyone says it is. Nowhere near as bad.
No, it's not. And at number 10 is the original with Robin Williams, Jumanji.
Jumanji!
So, as I mentioned, we have had Quicken the Dead, Apollo 13, and Strange Days all spoken about from that year on our podcast. And what's really interesting is the other films that are released. It's an absolute cracker of a year for other films. The Oscar darling that year was Braveheart. It was nominated for 10 Academy Awards and won 5, including Best Film, Best Director, Best Cinematography, Best Makeup, and Best Sound Effects Editing.
Yeah, well, it's very, you know, like, it came so much out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And this was really such a huge, obviously, because he'd already directed one, Man Without a Face, before that, but he just comes exploding onto it with this epic, just epic film. Yeah, you can see how it could just wash people away with it.
And it's interesting because when you start thinking about a film like Heat, the sound editing on Heat is phenomenal.
Oh, I would say better.
Definitely. And so you can see, I think, as can often happen with the Oscars, is hindsight shows that maybe there were some rose-tinted glasses on for some awards.
Well, and actually, I want to reserve that judgment until I look into it more.
I respect that, Craig.
You know what I mean? Like, because that sound editing, I don't know. Obviously, we know what you would logically think it is.
Yeah.
But to get it as, and I haven't watched Braveheart in a fair while, especially not in like some in-depth 4K, to actually get that sound best, to break it down and think. But I'm going to have a look at it. That's a rabbit hole I'll look into. I'll get back to you guys.
Thanks, Craig. I like that. Also released was Danny Boyle's debut film, Shallow Grave.
Oh, fantastic.
Leaving Las Vegas was released, which Nicolas Cage won a Best Actor
best
Oscar.
Ass. He got the best ass.
A great
really?
Ass.
I thought Elizabeth Shue would have got a great boobies that one because he drank bourbon off of boobies.
I've never seen Leaving Las Vegas. It is a hard film, man.
It is a very hard film. Like, they're both these just very hard characters. Like, they're not hard characters. They're just very heartbreaking characters. And nothing good happens for them. Poor guy. Seriously, it's fucking amazing acting. Elizabeth Shue was amazing.
I love her. Also released Dead Man Walking, in which Susan Sarandon won Best Female Actor.
True.
It was a big year for Australian cinema with Muriel's Wedding really sort of bursting onto the international market.
Terrible Muriel.
Also released were Outbreak.
Oh, good film.
Very apt for this time of year. A debut film for Michael Bay with Bad Boys.
What you going to do? That was a 15-year-old Megan Fox dancing in the nightclub.
In the first one, is there?
Yeah.
Oh, woo.
I know, that's the whole drama. There was a whole drama around. So she's one of the ones dancing in the nightclub, 15.
Tony Scott's Crimson Tide was released.
Fantastic, amazing, amazing film.
Another great Australian film, Babe the Pig, was released.
Oh, wow.
Written by George Miller. Desperado from Robert Rodriguez was released.
Desperado. Have you ever watched Desperado?
Yes. El Mariachi?
Yeah, El Mariachi. Sorry, not Desperado. El Mariachi, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's pretty darn good for a first film
Desperado
on such a tight budget. Also released is an incredible film called The Usual Suspects.
One of my favorite films of all time. Did my year 11 project on it.
Love it. Kevin Spacey won Best Supporting Actor and Christopher McQuarrie won Best Original Screenplay that year for that film.
Damn.
Casino was released.
What an amazing year, man.
Yep. Ang Lee's Sense and Sensibility was released. And Emma Thompson won Best Adapted Screenplay Oscar for that film.
Did she really?
She wrote and acted in it.
What? I did not know that. Oh my God.
How crazy is that?
That's amazing.
Lastly, Terry Gilliam's 12 Monkeys was also released.
Almost. Oh, no, it did get released. Oh, okay.
It did get released.
Sorry. I thought something happened. It almost got released.
So, that's the year sort of all wrapped up. And so following the release of Last of the Mohicans, Michael Mann starts looking towards what is going to be his next project. And in the very early 90s, Warner Brothers had started developing a biopic about the life of James Dean. Ooh. And by 1992, the project had actually moved as far as hiring playwright Israel Horovitz as the writer for the project. Now, a fun little side note, Israel Horovitz is, he's actually like a renowned American playwright, but his son is a very well-known and well-renowned musician.
Ah.
Now, Israel Horovitz's son is Adam Horovitz, or Ads Rock, from Beastie Boys.
Oh, is he really?
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
So it's a very talented, creative family there. So in September 1993, Variety announces that Michael Mann will direct the James Dean biopic using a script from Horovitz. Their aim was to commence filming in May 1994. And upon release of the sort of announcement, the rumors were that either Johnny Depp or Brad Pitt were the lead considerations for the role.
Fantastic.
Now, Mann decided that the best person for the job was an up-and-coming actor. He was going to take a real gamble on this young man named Leonardo DiCaprio.
Oh.
Now, DiCaprio had started gaining a lot of attention off the back of this boy's life, and in particular his role in What's Eating Gilbert Grape.
Yeah, fantastic.
And it was also listed that Gary Oldman would be a supporting role in the film as well. Not sure what role he would be playing, but there was going to be those two together. Now, Mann loved the idea of DiCaprio and approached him for the role. However, he really felt that DiCaprio wasn't quite there as a seasoned actor yet. And he needed just another year to really establish himself as a seasoned actor to be ready to take on such a big role. And in March 1994, it was announced that the James Dean biopic would be delayed 12 months in order to allow DiCaprio that time to make another movie and just get a bit more stuff under his belt. So
here's a quick question for you. Have you ever been on board with the James Dean?
I don't.
Iconic type stuff. Like, I've watched, obviously, Rebel Without a Cause. I've watched, I think, Hud. Prior to that,
yeah, I had, until I started researching Heat, I had no knowledge really about James Dean at all. I know about Rebel Without a Cause.
Yeah.
It's Without a Cause, isn't it? Yeah, sorry. That shows how much I know. I had no idea. I've since found out that I didn't know that James Dean was actually homosexual.
Yeah. He was everything sexual.
Yeah, and They actually, Horovitz talked about the fact that his script wouldn't focus on that aspect of James Dean's life. It would basically, they didn't want to get into something that was private for James Dean and could become speculation / sort of mudraking.
Yeah, which is sort of weird for a biopic. You don't want him to go private.
Yeah, it's strange, isn't it? But I think probably... we've probably moved on from a time where that is shunned. So you think about if they'd approached, say, an Elton John biopic back then, they probably would have danced around his sexuality because it was a time in the early to mid 90s where it wasn't as accepted as it is now. I also think it's fascinating here because as we move through this later stage of Mann's career, biopics are something that he does dabble in a little bit. He does get to Ali, but I know that he at one stage was going to direct The Aviator and develop that for a while. And he also developed Ford versus Ferrari.
Oh.
Before James Mangold took over. So I think he has a real sort of affinity with a biopic, and this is really the first time he's really starting to try and dive into it. So the film gets announced that it's going to be delayed for 12 months, and in the interim, Mann would focus his attention on another film that he'd been developing, which is Heat.
Oh, yes.
Now, in the announcement, it's announced that both Al Pacino and Robert De Niro were already attached to star in Heat. in 94. And the article later, as just this tiny little subline, it's a Variety article, just before the end of the article, is that Warner Brothers were looking for a replacement director for the James Dean biopic to keep it moving forward.
Do you know if they did?
Well, I thought we'd just... It's a really fascinating little idea around this James Dean biopic. So if it's cool, I'll just sort of round out what happened with that
yeah,
project.
Yeah, yeah, please,
so
please. I'm curious. Did it turn into the James Franco one?
Well, it did.
Oh.
And so the project had a revolving door for directors over the next couple of years. Des McAnuff, he was a director who had done stage plays and TV movies. He later would go on to direct the Rocky and Bullwinkle movie. so he was attached for a time. Dennis Hopper signed on to direct for a period, and he had already directed Easy Rider and was a close friend of James Dean.
Yeah, he loved him. He loved him. He still thinks he's the greatest actor that ever lived.
So Hopper was on there as director. Milko Mankiewicz, who did Before the Rain, had just been released. Now, this was an Oscar-nominated foreign film, and he's actually widely viewed as one of the best debut films ever directed. And so he was attached. Another man named Mark Rydell. Now, he had directed The Rose and On Golden Pond.
Yep.
And like Hopper, Rydell was also a close friend of James Dean's. So he came on board. Now, throughout all these director changes, DiCaprio was still signed on to star as Dean in the project.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Now, that all changes around sort of 1997, which is the release of a tiny little worldwide box office crushing film called Titanic.
Yeah.
By this stage, DiCaprio was an absolute megastar, and that's following the 1-2 punch. Like, we've got to give context here. DiCaprio's 1-2 punch of Romeo and Juliet and Titanic just absolutely put him into the stratosphere in terms of
and
star
posters
power.
That were inside of magazines.
He was literally everywhere. So by this stage, for the production of the James Dean biopic, the asking price for DiCaprio is way out of the reach of such a small film.
Yep.
So they do some rewrites of the film and start looking for a new lead, and they almost cast at one stage Stephen Dorff.
Okay.
And Ethan Hawke at one stage was attached to it.
Ethan Hawke more, yeah.
But the film actually ends up becoming one of those projects that gets stuck in development hell.
Oh, poor bugger.
So Warner Brothers then decide that perhaps for such a small contained film, this is a story that's best told for television. And so the result is that they then move the script on and start developing it so it became the TV film, which was 2001's James Dean starring James Franco.
Franco looked a friggin' part, man.
And it really signals the arrival of Franco, doesn't it?
Yeah, oh yeah. Franco before drugs was really good.
Totally.
He was really hardcore, man. He was a guy who you could have just blown everything out of water.
Have you seen the film? He did a great film with De Niro. Oh, man. Is it called City by the Sea? I could be wrong. There's a film where De Niro is a cop and his son is James Franco, and Franco becomes sort of, he becomes a drug addict.
Oh.
And the whole film is about De Niro trying to get him clean while finding where the drugs are coming from.
Oh, okay.
It's so good. And De Niro is fascinating in it. Franco is out of control good in it. It's probably around this same time it was released. So, yeah, there is a great actor in Franco. The problem is that Hollywood and probably all the associated things that come with Hollywood can warp a man to become not a great human.
Or heighten what was already there.
Yeah, yeah, totally, Craig, totally. So this brings us to the project that Mann left to pursue. And Heat definitely was not a project that just magically appeared in his brain post Last of the Mohicans and then became the thing that he develops. I guess prior to this season, I myself was quite naive to it, Craig. I thought that this was the project that just after Last of the Mohicans, Michael Mann had this idea probably just bubbling away, and he's like, all right, it's time to dig into it and get it happening. But I really had no context that this was a film that predates every feature film that Michael Mann had done.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I didn't realize it was a TV movie, like a pilot episode.
Yeah, it's really blew my mind. And so in my research for it, as I mentioned, I found this amazing documentary which Michael Mann talks the genesis and the whole creative period for Heat, which is really good. So get out there if you can find it. It's called Man Made. It goes for about 12 minutes and he talks about the journey, all the iterations of it in fascinating detail. But he had this really great quote about him thinking about projects and what it takes to get them off the ground. So he says, usually when I start out with a new project, it's sometimes an idea that I get or something I hear or an event that I know happened, or I'll meet someone who's totally fascinating to me. And then you try and construct the story around that. And so this sort of idea that he's been thinking about it, meeting people, is such an undercurrent for Heat. So it really is the culmination of his career so far. And he spends 20 years pondering and perfecting it.
Wow.
So as we mentioned in our last The Mohicans episode, all the way back before Thief, Mann had been developing a screenplay based around stories he'd heard through meeting a Chicago police officer, Chuck Adamson. And again, we've discovered that Chuck Adamson is essentially Michael Mann's muse for a lot of his television work, a lot of his film work, Thief. I think to an extent the police side of Manhunter is all linked to Chuck Adamson. And so he really sort of is this crucial part of Mann's career, because the meeting with Chuck Adamson is the person that inspires him to create the character of Vincent Hanna. And and as we really get into it, we discover that he talks about it quite openly. The meeting on the freeway and then going to the diner to have a cup of coffee is something that really happened with Chuck Adamson.
That's and fantastic.
This thief. And so there's all these true people and characters in real life that Mann met and started basing his characters upon. Even the shootout at the airport at the end of Heat is something that really happened between Chuck Adamson and this master thief that he was chasing. And I do love the way that the theme that runs throughout of two experts in their field who have a mutual respect for how great they are at what they do, but also identifying the fact that at some point this is going to come to a head, and in that moment we're going to have to choose what we do is more important than this right here.
It's the two sides of the same coin.
Yeah, love it, love it. So Mann had written a script before working on Thief, and it was around 180 pages, and he didn't feel as though the idea was quite ready to develop into something, so he popped it on hold and went on to work on a few other projects, including television and the film Thief. He also did that TV film The Jericho Mile as well in that time. Now, following the release of Thief, Mann decided to revisit the idea and basically did a rewrite of the script with the intention of pursuing it as one of his next feature films to direct. Mann goes on to make The Keep, and as you can go back and listen to our two-part dissection.
You can go down that rabbit hole if you want.
check it out, because it is pretty crazy. But during the promotion for The Keep, Mann gives an interview where he discusses that he was hoping his next film would be what we now know as Heat. I don't think it had the name Heat back there. I couldn't really verify that. I'll have to check with our buddy Blake on that. But he was unable to secure funding on that. So then he goes on to develop Manhunter and work on just some little TV series called Miami Vice and Crime Story.
I love Crime Story.
All along the way, drawing from experiences through Chuck Adamson and people he's meeting through all that. So both Miami Vice and Crime Story become huge successes for NBC. And Mann was again asked by NBC to produce another TV series. It was around this time that Mann felt that his script based upon Adamson's story and the character of Vincent Hanna would possibly be a great premise for a TV series where we would follow his work as a police officer through all these stages. And as we heard with Crime Story, he was starting to think of television as a possibility for long-form storytelling, which may not have been something the networks were quite prepared for just yet, but
definitely
something Mann was really thinking about. So what he decides to do is to then trim the screenplay for Heat down and see if he could fit it within a film to make a 90-minute pilot episode for the TV series. Actually, it was less than 90 minutes. He made essentially two TV episodes. Unfortunately, the pilot that he made wasn't picked up, and it was called LA Takedown. Well, actually, there's three different names that it's gone by. So it's like... Oh, I can't even remember the other ones, but there's like LA Takedown, there's LA City or something like that.
Let LA me just Heat.
It really does. They go through and they give these three names, and there's posters for all of it. LA Crime Wave and Made in LA are the three names that it all went
Made
on
in LA, that's horrible.
Yeah, I know.
Sounds like a reality show now for a tattoo company.
So true. So the pilot unfortunately wasn't picked up. And the reason that the pilot wasn't picked up was because Mann and the network had a little bit of a conflict about the casting of the lead role for Vincent Hanna.
Ooh.
Now, Mann chose Scott Plank as the role of Vincent, to which the network felt very strongly that a different actor was required. I guess if you're having a lead actor for a TV show, they want, off the back of Miami Vice, they want like your Don Johnson. They don't want to hear about, you know, Scott Plank, a relatively unknown actor, being the lead of a multi-million dollar TV series.
Did Scott Plank end up doing anything else? Or?
Well, let's have a little look now, Craig. I didn't go too much down the rabbit. Planky. he went on to have roles in Melrose Place.
Oh, huge.
But really, he didn't have a lot of work. His last feature film was the movie Holes that had Shia LaBeouf.
Oh, wow.
And so he didn't really have a huge career after. I think this might have been his... He'd done a bit of work in theatre, some Broadway productions. He was in the original cast of Dreamgirls on Broadway. But really, I think this was going to be his, if it got picked up, it was going to be his big break.
Crazy, eh?
Now,
just simple decisions.
Yeah, totally. And so the network felt very strongly that a different lead actor was required for this to be a successful TV series. They actually went as far as saying they wanted the TV series, but Mann's refusal to change the actor actually led to the NBC saying, sorry, we're not going to order the pilot to series.
That's crazy, man. They just must hate that poor dude, hey?
Yeah. And it's interesting. I did watch LA Takedown.
Yeah.
And Plank is very... It's very interesting. The way he acts the role is you can see Pacino in it.
Oh, really?
So his tone and that sort of high-pitched screaminess that can happen when he's upset, that is very prevalent throughout his acting. So the jump to Pacino is like, it's almost like a logical one watching Scott Plank's performance.
Oh, fantastic. Man, yeah. Now I've got to go watch it.
It's an interesting watch, actually, because what actually ends up happening for LA Takedown is they don't know what to do with this product that they've made, which is the pilot episode for the TV series. So they actually rework it a little and chop it together so the two episodes of the TV series then become the TV film LA Takedown.
So is it two separate storylines in the movie?
No, there's very distinct moments where you could see that an episode would end.
Oh.
So it's almost like, it's so fascinating because what takes a half an hour to get to in Heat is over in 10 minutes.
Oh.
So it's really fascinating. And the aesthetic of the film is so raw. You almost like... It opens with Hannah waking up next to his girlfriend and they go off and have sex. But it feels like you're watching like a dirty sort of 80s, 90s porn parody of the movie Heat. It's so bizarre.
Really? Oh, so like curtains flowing in the background and shit.
It's like a shower scene, and it's just, it's really interesting. And then you get to that first heist within the first like 4 minutes of the film. And so there's so much in the film that is present in Heat. It's crazy, but it's like you're just watching. Yeah, it's like a less budget version of it, and it's almost as if like someone went and cut out all the talky bits.
Oh, really?
So
that's hardcore.
It's such an odd experience, and it's really interesting because I think Mann is so great in his man-made documentary that he talks about comparing the two.
Yeah.
So he has this really, I'm remembering, I've written it for later in the episode, but he talks about they had something crazy, like there was 6 months pre-production for Heat and 107 days worth of filming, and LA Takedown was 10 days worth of pre-production and 19 days worth of shooting. So, and it shows, and he really goes on to talk about like the difference between LA Takedown and Heat is time and money. And he said, with most Hollywood projects, the biggest issue is time and money. If everyone had more time and more money, you'd get phenomenal films most of the time.
Mm.
But people are trying to do their best with what little of time and money that they have.
Plus, also, I guess your focus is different as well. You know, you're saying there's a lot of dialogue cut out, because I think you'd be like, well, if this gets picked up, the dialogue can be put through the season.
Yeah.
And totally. Also, if you want something to be picked up, I guess it's more action-based than it is dialogue-based, especially if it's a cop procedural film.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And Mann talks about it. He talks about, for television, people's attentions are different. Mm. Your scale, he has a fascinating thing in the documentary where he talks about the scale of television versus the scale of film. And so the scene where in Heat, the film, you've got De Niro and his crew are at the shipping yard around all the containers, and it looks like they're scoping out their next job, and they're being like monitored by Pacino and his crew, and really it's just to show them that they know that they're being followed. And that takes place just in the courtyard of, it looks like they're scoping out a bank in the a courtyard. And so Mann talks about the fact that like you can't go a ginormous scale in television because you don't have enough time to establish scale and things like that where you can in film. And so he needs to keep it punchy. And so it's really fascinating because, like I said, LA Takedown has those major scenes. The diner scene is there. And even lines such as, I can't remember it word for word, but you won't find me doing a cheap dime store robbery with a Born to Die tattoo on my chest. That's in there. The moment in the garbage truck at the start of the film where Wayne Grove's trying to weasel his way into the crew and saying, I can do any job, I can do this, and he's just like, shut up. That's in the film, you know. It's really quite fascinating. There are elements, the ending's a bit different. But overall, it's like you're getting this short, punchy version of Heat, where the foundations are all there, but it just feels different. It looks different. There's different people doing it.
Like a student film version.
It's definitely like that, Craig. It's like someone did the stage play and then decided that they were going to make a student film. It's a perfect description. Hey, yeah. It makes me think of that film. Have you ever seen that amazing film, Son of Rambo?
No, I haven't. I want to. It's always one of those ones that it always pops up because I think it's on high rotation through a lot of streaming services.
Yeah.
And you always see the kid on the poster, you know, and it's the Son of Rambo. Yeah.
Do you know who that kid is?
No.
It's Will Poulter.
Is that Will Poulter?
Yeah.
Man, I want that guy to do so much more.
Me too. Me too.
Especially after Detroit. Go watch Detroit, guys. Go look and listen to our episode too.
That's right. Detroit is a phenomenal film, and Will Poulter is so menacing in that film.
He's so much. He's so much more than Where the Millers. So I hope he's just not remembered for that, because he's so much more than that.
I think you said it best in that episode, Craig, which is Will Poulter was up for the role of Pennywise in It for a stage. Yep. And you watch Detroit and you realize that he was a really great choice for that film.
Yeah, exactly. You see how menacing.
Yeah. And so Mann has this great quote that I wrote down. He says that to compare LA Takedown to Heat is a bit unfair because the film LA Takedown is not fully developed. He says, to compare LA Takedown with Heat, it's like comparing freeze-dried coffee with Jamaican Blue Mountain. which, again, shout out to our sponsors, Glee Coffee. Love you guys. We're excited about it. In reflection, like what's really good is that Mann views the opportunity to shoot LA Takedown as the prototype for Heat. He says it was never the intention, but it was just a very fast prototype for Heat and an invaluable one, because what then happens is he got to see on screen the way some dialogues worked, the way some action sequences worked.
Oh, man, yeah.
And through that, he gets to tweak it, and he actually describes it. He says it's perfect because he gets to see where all the shortfalls were.
Yeah, actually very true, isn't it? Hey, so I guess he's sort of cheating in a way, doesn't he? Like, you know, he gets to see basically what works, what doesn't. It's just this cheap-ass pre-shot.
yeah. And it's crazy because it's almost unheard of for a director to have an opportunity to spend a couple million dollars having a first run at the film, almost pre-vising his film.
Yeah, exactly.
In a fleshed out form to then go, oh, you know, 10 years later, doesn't quite work. How am I going to punch it up a bit, you know, or 6 years later? So I think it's also interesting as well, because we talked about in Last of the Mohicans, he is so detail focused.
Yeah.
And so meticulous in his filmmaking that we sort of discussed about the jump from Mohicans to Heat, again, is such a large jump in quality of filmmaking.
Incredibly.
And I was wondering how he gets to be such a great director. And I guess, like you said, it's almost like he cheated in a way.
Yeah.
Because he gets a second go at it, which again sort of sets up his career, because he does then go and tinker with a lot of his films.
Oh, yeah.
Beyond
Heat. Very much tinkering. Yeah. I didn't realize how useless his definitive editions were. Look, I know they're not useless to a student, you know, I guess, or a filmmaker. It's like, oh my God, that's amazing. He just changed the tone of that whole scene. But to me, I'm one of those old school. If you're going to give me a director's cut, I want to see new shit. You know what I mean? I just don't want you to change the tone or add a line in or rearrange this and that. I want to see new shit. And to know that he's basically, his definitive cuts are always just like, you know, Al Pacino says hi instead of goodbye and shit like that. And the color coding, and he looks to his left instead of his right, and you just go, fuck it.
Yeah, yeah. And again, I love it because there is a definitive director's cut of Heat, which is what you and I both watched.
Yes, we did.
There is so little different, or they're so minuscule in detail as to what's different, that I honestly couldn't remember what was different in the film.
I can understand, like, for Blake, it's an amazing thing because you're going through every minute.
Yeah, yeah.
You're going through it every minute of the movie. So an extra 30 seconds is like, fuck, yeah, that's like half an episode. but I was like, oh, man, I didn't see pretty much anything.
No, and really when I look deeply into it, there isn't additional footage. Like, we're talking, there's minutes in it. So we're not Peter Jacksoning this thing and getting 45 minutes extra to an hour in the
film. See, I love that shit.
And if it works, I don't want the waffle version.
I want that Boromir subplot.
Oh, we've just gone through all the Lord of the Rings films too, and far out that two.
That Boromir subplot is needed, man. Is needed.
So
you actually feel Sean Bean more. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
He's not a callous character. He's so much more of a just tragic hero.
Yeah, totally, totally. And
him and his brother. Yeah.
And it plays out the subplot of his father later in Return of the King so well. So I'm glad that in a way, though, that Michael Mann is only fixing minute details in his films. Because one, it sort of shows that he's getting his idea on the screen for the majority of the film. But at the same time, it doesn't tamper with it in such a way that the film feels different.
Yeah, and, very true.
I watched a director's cut of Heat and suddenly the film felt slower, because when we watch this film, this motors along, Craig.
Oh, it's near perfect pacing.
It is, isn't it? And so, like, if there was another scene of dialogue in here, you know, and again, we'll get there a bit later, but all the actors start taking on characteristics of Michael Mann in this film. They all go off and try to do massive amounts of research, to the extent, I didn't know Ashley Judd spent time interviewing former prostitutes who'd become housewives.
Oh really?
Yeah, which is this whole side to her character, which she wouldn't research that unless that is some part of the history of her character that we don't ever see on screen.
Definitely.
Which again shows that relationship between her and Val Kilmer, it's so broken already, but knowing that knowledge that she's possibly a former prostitute who's now settled down, you know,
that better life, yeah.
That's exactly right. And her moments of pushing Chris in the film they're so crucial, because she never wants to see people getting addicted to gambling, which she's probably been around. People addicted to drugs.
Giving in when the police officer tells her the story.
Yeah.
You know, what will happen to Oliver. I think the kid's name Oliver, is it?
Yeah.
And what happened to a kid, and so why she decides to give up on, you know, and to actually join the police, you know. You just, yeah.
Love it. Love it, Craig. It's just so fascinating to me. And all these elements that, I guess, you know, if they'd thrown that sort of subplot in deeper, you may lose some pacing for Ashley Judd.
Yeah.
You know, and so we don't want to lose that, because the momentum is crucial to this film. And I love, Mann talks about the fact that Heat, in his mind, plays like a song. So he's like, every time there's action, that's the chorus. And so the verse is building us to the action. And so he paced it around scenes. So he's got a verse, which is, he starts that. Then we get the chorus, which is the heist. And then we get the verse, and we're going to meet more about the characters. Then we get some action. Then we get the verse.
Awesome.
And so
That's so good.
Yeah, he really approached it in that way. Which, again, as a musician, I love that approach to it. But he really... Again, too many verses become sort of bulky and unwieldy in a song.
Very true, very true.
So he really then moves on. He does his sort of following LA Takedown. He goes on, works on Last of the Mohicans, and returns around this time to that 1986 script that he'd written. This is pre-LA Takedown. I did find as well that Mann tried to get his friend Walter Hill to direct his 1986 script as well.
Really?
And he wasn't interested in it. So that was pretty interesting. So now I just wanted to touch back. I started giving a quote that Mann talked about finding a project, and I've got the remainder of that quote, which is that that when he's constructing the story, sometimes... He says, it sometimes takes quite a long time. So consequently, I'll begin something and take it to a certain stage. And it may even take the form of being a complete screenplay, as in fact Heat was. But I know there is something fundamentally amiss. There's something wrong with it. It doesn't really satisfy me. So then I might put it down and do something else for 3 or 4 years, which we see him do. And occasionally I've gone back to one or two of them, and Heat's one that I went back to. So we've had LA Takedown, finishes Mohican, starts working on Mohicans, and starts revisiting this 1986 script. And in returning to his 1986 script, which was the 180-page script, he feels this is really something that he wants to work on again. And so, as we talked about earlier in the episode, he goes on and starts developing the James Dean biopic while reworking the script for Heat. And he really felt like at this stage, this script is something that could be great. But he's committed to this James Dean biopic. So he offers the script to producer and friend Art Linson to try and find another director, to which, after reading the script, Linson says that this is such a great script that you got to do this as your next project. You can't give this to someone else to do. Which then the script gets passed from Linson to a very small actor called Robert De Niro.
Go, Bobby.
Who has a read. So, as we mentioned, in 1994, it's announced by Variety that Mann had delayed his James Dean biopic for 12 months.
Yep.
So that he could start filming Heat. And that announcement also announced that Robert De Niro and Al Pacino would star in the film.
So, that's so fantastic, man.
Straight off the bat.
Just those two just putting in a film, and they haven't been in a film together since not really ever in a film, but, you know, since Godfather.
And really, in the promotion for Heat, they focus so much on those two actors. And it's really interesting, in my research, the script went to De Niro and he signed on straight away, and he passed the script on to Pacino and said, "You got to look at this. I'm going to do it. I want you to do it with me." And so,
I love that phone call. Yeah. I want that phone call or that lunch or whatever it was. I just want that phone call.
You can imagine he'd be like, "Al, it's Bobby. I got a script for
you. You got a great ass."
Hey, little side note. I had no idea that was my knowledge of this film was so minimal aside from the film itself. Yeah. I didn't know that was an off-the-cuff sort of improvised moment in the film.
Oh, well, you could tell it would throw off anyone and you'd be like, "Oh, okay."
If you go back and watch the film, you can actually see Hank Azaria trying not to laugh in that moment.
He does.
Yeah, because he had no idea it was coming. It's just like out of the blue, everyone didn't know it was happening. And funnily enough, the script actually focused on the fact that Al Pacino's character is a cocaine addict.
Yep.
So those moments... there is opportunity that in a director's cut we could have been told that information more. And those outbursts from Pacino make sense. He's wild and manic in that moment. And again, the moment where he's like confronting his girlfriend who is sleeping with someone else. And
good actor, that guy who he's sleeping with too.
And he actually plays the character of Wayne Grow in LA Takedown.
Do you know that the actor Wayne Grow... Yeah, he went to jail for 18 months.
No way.
Yeah, man, for selling marijuana.
Really?
Yeah. So got released, I think, because they lessened the marijuana rulings around there. But yeah, wow. And he was married or engaged to Kelly Preston before John Travolta.
No way.
I know, man, because I won't lie, I almost did a death of an extra on him.
Oh.
But I basically, I just... got caught up in stuff, but yeah, and man, that dude just basically had a huge marijuana rap, man. It was for 18
so
months.
So crazy.
He had to.
Of all the people in this film that could get arrested for something, he's probably the least likely in my mind.
I'm talking about the actual. Sorry, we're getting confused. The guy
you're talking about, the
Wayne
guy with the mullet.
The guy who plays Wango in this movie. Him. Yeah. I used to get him confused with the guy, obviously, who's also in this film, who played Buffalo Bill out of Silence of the Lambs.
And do you know what's really funny is the guy that played Buffalo Bill in Silence of the Lambs, it's a really funny story. He was a friend and used to act on stage with William Peterson.
Oh, did he?
Yeah. And so when they finished filming Manhunter, there was a rap party to which William Peterson invited him to come to the party. And that's where he met Michael Mann.
Oh.
And so the connection is that also at that same party is the De Laurentiis couple who were the producers for Silence of the Lambs.
And who owned
all the rights for the Hannibal Lecter sort of verse. So he actually met all those people through Michael Mann's Manhunter to go on to do Silence of the Lambs, to come back to do Heat.
The other day I had a spare 45 minutes and I watched 45 minutes of the new Silence of the Lambs series called Clarice.
How is it?
It's with an Australian girl who plays Jodie Foster's character. And It could have been so much more if it was done by another place. Because it's a TV show, like literally a TV show. It has that TV show feel to it. But yeah. It actually has all these flashbacks to Silence of the Lambs film. So, like the actual Silence of the Lambs film. Yeah. But even though Lecter isn't in it, it's about Clarice something like 12 months after that. After the whole Silence of the Lambs thing. And so they're asked, the girl who she saves, you know, the girl she saves out of the thing, basically her mum, the senator, is now the head of the Department of Justice.
Oh, wow.
And wants her in to, you know, for publicity and all this stuff. And, yeah, gets into this whole drama. But, yeah.
So
and
good.
It was just, yeah, it you can see how much the problem is, it seems like such an imitation. Like, even her, she seems like a good actress, but she does such a good interpretation of, like, well, she doesn't do an interpretation. She just copies Jodie Foster.
Yeah.
And she should have just thrown a little bit more interpretation instead of imitation.
Yeah. And I do love, we've talked about Hannibal, the TV series. I'm still on the Hannibal train at the
moment.
See,
that's an interpretation.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
So, like, well done.
He never, not once does he try to be.
He's not trying to be Peterson. He's just doing his own thing.
But also, like, you know, like, he's not trying to be friggin' Hannibal, like you know.
Oh, Brian Cox,
Hopkins,
you mean?
Lecter.
Yeah, totally. I love it. So, Craig, they start doing some pre-production for the film. And as I mentioned, it's 6 months of pre-production they do for this film. Michael Mann goes on and does his usual thing, which is to dive headfirst into research.
Yep.
In-depth research.
Rob Banks and shit.
Well, he actually spent every Friday and Saturday night for 9 months in the lead-up to filming on patrol with an LAPD officer.
That'd be fantastic.
So he would answer emergency calls with them, just be present for everything. So you can imagine he wants to get to know. By this stage, he's had so many connections with prisoners and thieves that you would think he was pretty well versed in the crime side of things, but he wanted to know what it all plays out like from a police perspective.
Can you imagine a fucking dinner with Michael Mann and Catherine Bigelow talking about spies and criminals and shit?
Oh my god.
Terrorism and shit. Did you fucking hell? These guys are awesome.
Do you know what? I feel like them collaborating on, say, like a HBO Max TV series would just be like the ultimate. But they might be like, you know, when two people are so alike that when they become,
they'd hate each other.
So it may not work at all. I think they both would not compromise on their vision in such a way.
Oh,
but
fuck no. Yeah, it's very true, man. They would need to be apart for a whole good chunk.
Yeah. But maybe an anthology series where they work on stuff would be incredible. So with pre-production underway, Mann's doing his research. They're set for filming summer in 1995. So what's incredible, Craig, is they literally film in the summer and it's released in the winter. So quick turnaround time in terms of filming. When you think it's over 3 months worth of filming, then editing for such a big film is literally in 3 months it's released. So they begin casting. And as we mentioned, De Niro and Pacino are locked in. Now, this one is the mind blow of my research in here, Craig. So get your wow ready. But initially, Michael Mann approached Val Kilmer to play the role of Chris.
Yep.
Now, unfortunately, Val Kilmer had to decline the role because he'd signed on to play Batman in Batman Forever. So Mann then was forced to reach out and find another actor. And there were rumors that potentially that role would be played by Brad Pitt.
Ooh.
And you could totally see him in that role.
Oh, well, he's coming off that 12 Monkeys.
12 Monkeys is
deranged.
Released this year. He's probably really big off the
Seven.
Back of Thelma and Louise. He's an up-and-coming person with Seven and 12 Monkeys coming out in 95.
Yeah.
Probably was too busy. Maybe one of the reasons he wasn't in the film.
Very true.
But Mann then approaches another star who is monstrous at this stage. He's coming off the back of a massive 1991 hit in the film Point Break. And fresh off 94's Monstrous Speed. Man actually approaches and signs Keanu Reeves for the role of Chris.
Fuck, what?
Yep.
That's mind-blowing.
Now,
wow. Am I serious?
Yep, yeah.
That's the mind-blow of my young life, man. That's a...
Keanu Reeves was signed on for this role. Now, unfortunately for Keanu Reeves, Val Kilmer manages to negotiate with the production of Batman Forever that he would film both Batman Forever and Heat at the same time.
Damn.
And go back and forward between the films. So, as a result, then Mann has to say to Keanu Reeves, I'm sorry, I really wanted Val Kilmer for this role. We're going to go with Val. And
I think Val is a better actor.
This role is... I was actually a bit surprised at how little of Chris was in this film compared to what I remembered.
Yeah. I think that's because of his ability. He takes up most of the screen when he's in it.
Yeah, very much so. And you can't help... Like, this is a... it's really interesting. I've already watched our next film. And in it, I think the film was meant to be, which is The Insider. And something that really struck me in The Insider is the film's meant to be a Pacino film with a supporting role from Russell Crowe. And Russell Crowe is literally such a screen stealer in that film.
Russell never supports. Let's just be fucking honest. Yeah. Russell never supports. And I don't mean that in because he's a conceited guy. But like if you think through every scene in Man of Steel,
yep.
Like just talking supporting roles that he plays, he never ever supports, man. He's just a fucking a monster in himself, man. He just
Man
presence
of Steel
is fantastic.
Is such a great example because you watch that and you're like, I could honestly have a Jor-El TV series or movie starring Russell Crowe and I'd be so happy.
I just want to watch Russell Crowe just fly in and out of adventures on those little winged beasts.
Yeah, the Avatar things. So, but it's so true for Val Kilmer in this film because the moments that he's on, Val Kilmer is just like, his presence is so massive in this film.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I love incredibly. It.
So they go on to lock in the remaining cast members. A lot of them are people that Michael Mann's already worked with before. Tom Sizemore's brought in. You know, the crew, he met Danny Trejo working in Folsom Prison. So
Danny.
And so this is actually Danny Trejo's first film.
Is this his first film? Because did you say Desperado was released this year?
Desperado was released this year, but Trejo was brought on as a consultant for Heat through connections. So Michael Mann, throughout his career, has met people in Folsom Prison and used them for his research purposes. Danny Trejo is brought on as a consultant for this to talk about what life like is for ex-cons. And in meeting him, Mann's just like, oh, man, I've got to give you a role in this film.
He's got the best, most unique face. He's like Ron Perlman.
He looks so young and old at the same time in this film, doesn't he?
Oh, fucking oath, man. He looks like just instead of being racist to his whole body, but he looks like a fried fajita. He's just fucking
I love
scary.
It too.
Like a guy you've seen in jail.
Oh, definitely. And he was a person that was in prison. So he's an ex-con that's really turned his life around, hasn't
but
he?
But isn't he... what's your name's cousin? Like the sorry, what's El Mariachi's director?
Robert Rodriguez.
Yeah, isn't he his cousin?
Oh, I don't know about that. We'll have to look into that one, Craig.
Yeah, I'll Google it.
Thanks, man. So they lock in all the cast and start giving them research to do. So, you know, the people who are part of De Niro's crew go off and do tactical training on how to realistically act out those moments of heisting things.
Yeah.
And a little interesting note that I found is that Val Kilmer, his ability to shoot and reload while shooting is so good that they actually use footage of Heat for future military training. So you could watch him reload his guns and go, this is the way you should do it.
I think, though, Reeves would have done it better.
He's a bit of a machine on the old weapon, isn't he?
Oh, isn't he? He's fucking quite wild on his machine. Wild. Maybe that's what pissed him off. He's like, fucking, I can reload a gun better than that. And so he spent the rest of his life just trying to outgun Val Kilmer.
So good. Hey, side note, did you watch that Matrix Resurrections trailer?
Blow your fucking mind.
Craig, I am so on board. It's disgusting.
I'm just so pumped for that show, for that movie, that I just... I don't know what to say. You know what I mean? Like, I just feel that movie.
Yep.
I just feel it.
Yeah, totally. I'm the same. It's incredible. Also, the casting for young Morpheus is so spot on.
So is he a young Morpheus?
He's come out and say, I think what it's going to end up being...
Because obviously you see him with the whole Morpheus stuff on there.
I think it's going to be like a reincarnation for a lot of them. You know how the Oracle has... This is Jeff Reed's theory, everybody, not what I know.
Well, you see the Oracle in there. She's the one with Alice in Wonderland.
And cool. So the Oracle in Matrix, from the Matrix to Matrix Revolutions, is a different Oracle. And she talks about sometimes they come back in different forms and things like that. And I think what we'll find is that the end of the Matrix ends up being like they're coming back in different forms in a whole new iteration of the Matrix.
Because we can just constantly recast them.
But I love him as a young Lawrence Fishburne. It's just like
he's
such
fantastic.
Great.
He's a damn good actor, man, from what I've seen. I can't wait to see Candyman.
Yeah, I can't wait for that either. So where were we, Craig? We've just gone on a tangent, but what a wonderful tangent that was.
Exactly. And just another side note, John, stop frigging messaging us, okay? We're doing a podcast. He's on our little group messaging something.
Like, Uncle Buff Buff, he wants to be part of this.
We're podcasting, mate. We're podcasting.
Love it. So they begin shooting in the summer of 1995. And as I mentioned, it lasts for 107 days. Now, we'll probably go into a bit more detail next week. Blake Howard is an absolute wizard in how much knowledge he knows about the production itself. So yep. I'm going to just sort of skim through this a little bit because I know he's going to just really tackle a whole heap of stuff next week. And I don't want to cut some grass when the expert could talk about it, if that makes sense. But... they completely shot this film on location. There were zero sound stages that they filmed on.
Dang.
So you can imagine the logistics of shooting in streets of LA, having to close down streets, having to block off things so they could do that heist scene when they actually do the robbery, and the shootout is just massive.
That's not some back alley area, man. That's like full hardcore, whatever
it is. Downtown LA, isn't it?
Damn.
It's so incredible to think. I can't imagine. And I think there's not a lot of... There are some night scenes, but there's not... It's a good mix of film, really, in terms of... but like what I love is that when we say there's no sound stages, that means that... Most people don't realize that a lot of the times when you're watching the inside of an apartment or the inside of a bank, those are sets built somewhere that's a controlled environment that can be moved and manipulated so a camera can move through those things. Now, none of that was done for Heat. The inside shots are shots of banks.
Yeah,
you know,
fantastic.
The inside of the apartment, which is that Art Deco sort of apartment that Pacino's living in with his girlfriend, that's an apartment. They're filming within an apartment. And you could imagine if you ever see a shot behind the camera of how many people are actually on set at any given time, I can't imagine that little apartment having 30, 40 people in there trying to work sound and lighting. And
there's a fantastic TikTok account where it's done by the cameraman and he shows all of these.
Oh, really?
Like he shows this one where they've got a prep for Christmas, a Christmas movie. And so it's just a footage of it coming down the stairs, and it shows how they built the crank to go down the stairs. But it also shows how just in that shot, just outside on the pathway, there's all this snow, but it's only like a little bit out of the pathway, just so it's in the shot.
Yeah,
and it
wow.
looks fantastic. It's amazing. Yeah.
Oh,
get
that's
on there.
So
I can't.
Good.
I'm sorry, I can't remember the dude's name, but I'm pretty sure he's easy to find because I think he's pretty huge on there.
Maybe you could find out for us, Craig. We'll share some stuff on the socials. That'd be great. So they film the film. It really, I want to dive into the diner scene just as one little factor in all of this, because there was some awesome stuff about the shooting of that diner scene as well.
Yeah.
Now, I love that diner scene, which if we're to talk penultimate scenes within a film, the diner scene.
Can you just quickly just do a little quick setup just in case someone hasn't watched it?
Yeah.
Some weird nutbag who's listening to this going, Heat? Oh, wow. So when's Sandra Bullock coming into this?
they haven't people? Mentioned Melissa McCarthy once.
Once, not once. They think they know about movies?
Well, the setup is that throughout it, we know there's a police officer. He's trying to, a heist has happened, played by Robert De Niro and his crew. Al Pacino's a police officer that's investigating the fallout from that heist. The investigations lead so much so that they then discover that there is a crew operating that are doing professional heists, and it leads Pacino to be monitoring Robert De Niro. Now, Robert De Niro discovers that he's being sort of tailed and they're being investigated, and there's a little game of cat and mouse sort of going on. And it all sort of builds to this crescendo, which is while driving on the freeway, suddenly police lights go on behind Robert De Niro. He gets pulled over and it's Al Pacino. And Al Pacino literally walks over to the window and says, "Can I buy you a cup of coffee?" And so they end up at a diner, which is at an airport. Is that right? I think it's at an airport.
Oh, I can't
maybe.
Remember.
But the diner they end up at, that both De Niro and Pacino sit down and have a coffee together, and the whole scene plays out while they talk about, you know, they're aware of each other, that if the time comes, this doesn't count for anything, they're going to have to stop each other. And awesome. It's just this incredible scene that is shot beautifully. It's sound is just incredible. Even to the extent I love. So in the setup for that scene, obviously, if you have a massive scene that everyone knows, most actors would have rehearsed the heck out of it so that they're ready to just pump it out, get the best performance they physically can. Now, De Niro actually requested that he and Pacino have one read through so the lines sounded good. But after that, they would not have any more rehearsals leading into it. So they go awesome. In pretty dry on that scene. And what he wanted it to be is he wanted that tension to be as present as physically possible. And you really feel it in there. It's like they both, I love, we talk about, check out our socials. There's a great video on there from last season about the 180 degree rule, which is like how a camera angle can set your mind up to feel discomfort in a conversation. And
yep.
Michael Mann breaks that rule, and he breaks it purposely because you want to feel on edge throughout that. You want to know that these are both two bulldogs staring each other down. But
yeah they're circling each other.
That's exactly right, and you feel it so much, and it's actually incredible. It wasn't until the 11th take that they felt that they got that scene properly. Yeah, I know, 11 takes of it. And in it, Mann talks about in the editing process that they were actually, they had a wide shot as well, because the entire diner scene plays out over each other's shoulders, shot over each other's shoulders. And they started dropping in a couple wide shots to see them talking to each other in the one frame together. And Mann talks about it feels like the tension balloon was just let out. And so they just knew that they couldn't pull out wide until the conversation was over, because it just was breaking the tension too much. And it really is such an incredible scene that I could just sit down and pull apart minute by minute. I get why Blake did what he did, because the more I think about the film Heat, the more I'm blown away by how much is in it and how deep it is and How incredibly punchy it is while almost being 3 hours long. It's just it's a mentally good film. So
it's a peak.
They wrap filming after 107 days. The film released on the 15th of December 1995. And as I mentioned, it took $187.4 million worldwide on a budget of $60 million.
Superb, man. Hey, it's just a superb. And it's one of those things where you have faith in the movie-going audience that it actually did well.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because a lot of these films, sometimes you just go, oh, why did it go so crap upon release? You know what I mean?
Totally.
But you just go, actually, no, these people know what they're doing if it's done right. Like, I always say the perfect example of a film like that is, like, if you go and watch Inception.
Yeah.
Because it's just a mindfuck of a concept to try to get across. But he gets it across so well that it's still a hit. You know what I mean?
And yeah, totally. I love it. And I do love man's influence on modern cinema. You can't watch a Christopher Nolan film without seeing little fingerprints of Michael Mann popping up.
Mannisms.
Yeah, totally, Craig. So, Craig, that's The Journey to Screen. As we mentioned, this is part one of our episode.
Yeah.
We're about to just really dive into the film with our buddy Blake Howard.
We're about to talk to Yoda.
Yeah.
Oh, Michael Mann. You know what I mean? Like,
we sure are.
I'm nervous because I'm worried he's just going to go, wow, you two Padawans shouldn't even be in the Academy. But
hey, it could be worse, Craig. I'm the guy who's trying to sound like he knows what it's about because he's done research, and I could end up being the guy who stabs himself in the foot with his sword and he's like, yep, you weren't ready for that lightsaber at all, buddy.
Actually, that's quite right. Yeah, that's quite right. Maybe I'm very lucky being the stupid monkey, the dancing monkey. Because you can't get angry at the dancing monkey. Who gets angry at the dancing monkey?
He's wearing a little vest. He's cute.
Exactly. Get angry at the accordion guy. You know, get angry at the accordion guy. We were talking about this in our messages the other day. I'm Ned from the new Spider-Man movies, Jeff's Peter Parker. You don't get angry at Ned. No one gets angry at Ned.
No,
get angry
way
at Peter Parker. I'm
that's
just a
exactly
dude in the
right.
behind. Him.
That's exactly right. That's exactly
just a
right.
fat Filipino coming over for dinner.
For a weird Mexican lasagna concoction.
That's awesome.
As long as there's chorizo there, I'm on board, Craig. So the film's cool. released. I'm really excited for next week when we dig into the film itself.
Yep.
Now everyone's got a context of its journey to screen. Now, Craig, where can people find us?
Oh, Guys, get on the Twitter, get on the Instagram, go at FFTL Podcast, man. Get on there, click the little hearts, you know, share us, share what we're saying, everything. Get onto Facebook from First to Last Podcast, you know, get on there and comment and we'll comment back to you. But if you want to go more in depth, if you have a big, big hardcore rant that it goes beyond the actual case limits, go email us at info@fftlpodcast.com or just browse through our site, www.fftlpodcast.com.
Love it, Craig. Now, if someone's listening, I might be putting you on the spot here, Craig, which I can jump on the app and check out. Where can people watch Heat if they've listened to this episode and said, oh, man, I haven't watched this movie in a very long time. I owned it on Blu-ray. Are there any
I got it on Blu-ray. You can actually get it on I think it's on Disney Plus now.
Really? I'm just jumping on right now. I'm jumping on right now.
Because I think it was bought out by Fox or something like that. So
having a look, it's streaming on Amazon Prime at the moment.
Okay, that's, cool. Amazon Prime. Get on Amazon Prime. Look, it's on YouTube Movies, obviously. It's on Microsoft, those types of food.
Yeah.
Because it's such a big film.
It totally
You know what
is.
I mean? Like, my honest opinion, guys, go out to your local Blu-ray auditorium and get it there.
That's right. Get it in the best quality you can because the sound, the visuals are just so required for this film, aren't they?
Exactly. And look, seriously, don't borrow money to get the director's definitive cut. you're not. It's not going to make or break the watching pleasure of this film. All the best bits are still there.
Yeah.
There's not much big of a difference.
Nah, not at all. So, Craig.
Exactly.
as we say every week, please subscribe. Please
subscribe.
Share us with a friend. Give us a review. Chuck those 5 stars on us.
Get on there.
Yeah, get on there. And jump on to gleecoffee.com.au. Buy yourself some nice beans.
FFTL.
Yeah, use the code FFTL. You get 15% off. I used it to get a jumper the other day. It was a little bit cold. Got a nice warm hoodie. They got some great hats on there as well. Summer's coming. So get yourself a hat. Get yourself protected.
Or if you're overseas, winter's coming.
Winter's coming, that's right. Hopefully by now they've got their international shipping on there as well. They've got some like blends that were like golden bean winners. That's like an international bean prize for coffee.
Oh, wow, I didn't even know there was a golden bean.
Yep, golden bean. They won last year. So get on there, check it out, gleecoffee.com.au. Next week, we are so psyched because we do have Blake Howard on for our second part. And
yay, Blake.
I can say without any hesitancy, this is going to be a great episode. I can't wait. It's going to be so much fun. So from all of us here at From First to Last Podcast, I'm Jeff Reed.
I'm Craig Killian.
And we'll catch you next week.
See you, dudes.